Hello, I am Randy Andrews, and this week I've got Tim Benson with me as we talk about X-Men with regard to the release of Logan today. We will talk about how X-Men has changed over the years and more on Soundtrack Alley. Hello, Tim.
Hey.
Glad to have you on the show again today.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, we've got a full show talking about X-Men from the year 2000, so we can even get into some really cool music of Michael Kamen.
Yeah.
I found that Michael Kamen, he's done so much throughout his career. He did Highlander, he did Die Hard, he's done so much, and his career has been full of different types of movies that he's been compared with. Many people may say that the director of X-Men, they're not real big fans of Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
But I myself, I'm a big fan of Bryan Singer because he's consistent.
Yeah.
He's very consistent with his way of bringing out the characters for, like, X-Men in particular. And then it's been kind of a true passion for him to kind of keep things consistent and chronologically correct.
Yeah, I mean, he's failed miserably at keeping all six movies in the same universe, mm-hmm. which is what he's gotten a lot of criticism from fans. But I mean, I think the highlight here is it's the year 2000. This is one of the first of the, you know, current generation of superhero movies. And so people were a lot more critical in the same way they are of Superman. Like, we don't get very many superhero movies, or we did, especially in 2000.
Yeah.
This was, I mean, it was Spider-Man and then X-Men. And so everyone wanted it to be the X-Men. And Bryan Singer brings a little bit more Hollywood to it.
Yeah.
He's okay with stretching lines and crossing lines. And he wanted to tell a good story. And I think long-term, he's put out some great superhero movies.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't by the books. And mm-hmm. I'm okay with that.
Well, and especially with X-Men 1, the first X-Men movie, it was an original story.
Yeah.
It wasn't a story told that brought in extra characters or, I mean, it did bring in tons of characters, but the storyline wasn't from the comics. It was an original storyline that he came up with, and I thought that was great.
Yeah, I think almost every one of them has the origin story, and I think he did a good job of not weighing the movie down with an origin of the X-Men. We got pieces of it little by little, being told through the origin of one character. So I thought that was an effective way of bring a huge group of characters onto the screen without bogging it down. There's no way you could go to source material.
No.
You know, you go to the original five, and it's just not, that's not the five characters audiences wanted to see in the year 2000. And so you can't go to source material because you have, you know, years of history. So I think there's no way to go to source material for any superhero movie. And he's done a good job of coming up with a new story, so.
Yeah, and I really liked the fact that throughout the years that we've seen X-Men movies, Bryan Singer has brought something more to the series, keeping the chronological movement of the series moving. And, I mean, he did the first trilogy. He's done the second trilogy.
Yeah, he got dropped for the third movie, which I'm sure he's glad he's not associated with that movie at all.
I think that should have been probably two movies.
Oh yeah,
or if not three.
The X3.
Yeah,
it was just a bad movie.
Yeah,
you're so happy to see those characters, but I still watch it and I still enjoy it, but it was bad. But I mean, for me, Bryan Singer. Nobody had any problem with him for X-Men. People made fun of the suits, but that's just what it was, you know?
There was an in-movie joke about Wolverine wearing the yellow spandex. Who really wants to see Wolverine in those yellow spandex? No one.
Yeah, I think he takes the burden of being the first, you know?
Yeah.
Because after X-Men, you see Daredevil in the leather suit, and you start to see, you know, other characters in superhero movies starting to wear more realistic costumes than spandex. Like, come on, nobody thinks spandex would really, like, if I'm a superhero, I'm gonna go get spandex. I'm like, no. So I think he was just the first one to have to bear that. And so I think costumes were a big joke, but nobody had any problem with X-Men 1.
No.
Nobody had any problem with X-Men 2, and I'm sorry, like the Nightcrawler scene in X-Men 2.
That was pretty amazing.
Like, I don't care what Bryan Singer does. Like, he gets lifetime credit for that.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, we're all over the place here. I'm all over the place. But then he made Superman Returns, and his name was just forever tainted with comic fans.
But I wouldn't say that.
I don't have a problem with it.
For me, I enjoyed that movie, but I'm a big fan of the original Superman, and it brought all those feelings back.
And I feel like a lot of people felt like he just stepped all over the original by making Superman Returns. And so, like I said, he bears the burden of being the first.
The first, yep.
And so,
yeah.
But X-Men, the year 2000... it was amazing.
Yeah, it was a really decent movie. I mean, you got really high credits for the actors in the movie. Yeah. You get Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
You get Ian McKellen. They're both British actors that were Broadway actors first. And they became, you know, they were friends even before X-Men. Yeah. And that's what kind of kept that, like, chemistry on screen. For both of them.
Definitely. Yeah, the Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, you know, Professor X, Magneto, that was the movie for me. I mean, that was just so great. Ian McKellen as Magneto is just fantastic.
Yeah.
So I thought those were great casting choices. And the chemistry between the two characters is wonderful. So.
Yeah. And even with James Marsden as Cyclops.
Yeah.
There was a scene in the movie where they're at the train station, him and Storm. Halle Berry's character, and there's a boy that is there in the train station, and Cyclops looks down at him and he smiles, and Bryan Singer kept it in the film because it was so natural, and the kid loved X-Men, and in particular loved Cyclops. So it was unplanned, but the kid was a huge X-Men fan, so things like that, when you look back on previous episodes that I've done, like with Steven Spielberg, he used different elements to bring out a reaction from a child, such as Close Encounters.
Yeah.
And I've talked with Eric Woods, and he was talking about E.T. That's another one that used these elements to get a proper reaction out of a child. And it just works.
Yeah, I think Cyclops is probably one of my least favorite X-Men.
Yeah.
Just in general. And James
Marsden,
who plays him, he's grown on me. He's made some recent stuff, and I think he's really good in the humorous.
Yeah.
You know, but in that serious role, he's not so great. But that scene with the little kid, that really, like, solidifies the type of character Cyclops is.
Yeah.
You know? And so I'm glad they leave that in right before you go into, like, heavy drama.
Yeah.
You know, we'll talk Hugh Jackman a lot, but the Cyclops Wolverine you know, humor, the banter back and forth was a strong element for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart, again, a strong element with the two of them. Halle Berry, probably my least favorite actress. One of the, like, my least favorite of all time.
The element of what she had done in that movie, she didn't bring a lot to that film.
Yeah.
She got, like, they changed her character when they brought out the new X-Men movies with, X-Men Apocalypse. And that Storm was amazing.
Yeah, and I think... you can tell, like, the 2000 X-Men, there's, you know, the humor, the banter between Cyclops and Wolverine. You have these characters, and Storm was given some really...
poor lines.
Really tough dialogue to deliver. Yeah. And I just don't think Halle Berry is an actress who can pull off that funny line.
Yes.
And she's good in other types of roles.
Mm-hmm.
She was in this horror movie that I'm blanking on the name, but she was fantastic. Gothica.
Okay.
I really liked her in that because there's no humor in that movie. But I mean, X-Men, she's asked to pull off some, like, really tough dialogue.
Well, they had originally asked Angela Bassett to be Storm.
I'd feel the
and
same way.
And I could
way.
See that.
Yeah, I think she would have delivered the same, though.
I don't know. She could do pretty good.
Yeah.
So, yes, you know, you talked about Hugh Jackman, and the thing about Hugh Jackman is he's just perfect for Wolverine, even though Wolverine in the comics is only 5'3".
Yeah.
But they even had to have Cyclops wear...
razors on his shoes.
Yeah, he had to wear stilts or something on his shoes to make him taller than Wolverine.
Yeah.
So that way it appeared that he was shorter, even though Hugh Jackman is like 6'1".
Yeah. Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. There's no question that, he's probably the greatest actor in a superhero genre.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. He's the credit he gets right now, it's like the old credit with how many movies David Carradine being in the most movies of all time. Well,
yeah.
Hugh Jackman's been in the most, like, superhero movies. I think he's up to like 10 or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
X-Men 1, 2, 3, Days of Future Past,
First Class.
Was he in?
He made an appearance
without
in
cameos,
class.
You know, yeah. But he had the 4 X-Men movies, the solo, the 2 solo movies, and then the reason we're doing X-Men today is
because of
Logan.
Yep.
Logan comes out, and to jump over the place again, Logan, I assume you've seen the trailers.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash, Hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, they just keep coming up with wonderful ways to use that song.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting when Hugh Jackman prepared for the role of Wolverine, he would take cold showers. I found it in my notes that every morning before filming, he'd take a cold shower to get into character. And the tradition started when jumping into the shower at 5 a.m. and realizing there was no hot water. And he was shocked awake, but not wanting to wake his sleeping wife. He grit his teeth and bore it, and before realizing that, this was the mindset, that he wanted to scream, lash out at something, but having to hold it in, that's the type of character Wolverine was, that he had this inner conflict that he couldn't lash out, but then he's got this animal type of attitude that brings out the claws.
Yeah, now that's... I hadn't heard that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of funny. But
such a mundane thing, but it helps an actor get into character. Yeah, to be able to hold that in.
Yeah, and, his scenes with Mystique or Rebecca Romijn Stamos. I mean, she was the martial artist for the Brotherhood of Mutants.
Yeah.
And she was the fighter. And so she fought Wolverine, and she even, made herself look like him to make it harder for the other people to identify.
That's so surprising I mean, you look at the villains, the Brotherhood. You look at, so it's Magneto, Mystique, the Shapeshifter, and then this is probably the worst call of the whole like writing sequence is Sabretooth and Toad.
Yeah.
Like Sabretooth is fine. We see a great Sabretooth in the later movies, but this one, this version of Sabretooth was just.
He was a hired thug.
Yeah, he was dumb.
Yep.
And I mean, I guess you can only have so many characters on screen. And
they could have chosen different characters.
Yeah, you could have had. I mean, if you're not going to play up the Sabretooth Wolverine thing, don't use Sabretooth.
Yeah.
If you just want a hired thug, bring in, you know, Blob or bring in some other X-Men character. But to bring in a really dumb Sabretooth, I thought was a waste.
Yeah.
And then Toad, like, whatever. Toad's one of the originals, you know, so that's fine. And I thought they
did use his real voice.
Yeah. I thought they made Toad okay, you know, mm-hmm. with the spit stuff.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he was the bearer of those really bad Storm jokes. But I mean, to get Ray Park
to
play that
role—that's pretty awesome.
And then to not really utilize—I mean, he had some you know moves throughout the movie, but to not just embrace Ray Park's abilities.
Yeah,
what a waste.
Yeah.
So
I hear you, but you know, we get a lot of you know really interesting different dynamics from a lot of the different characters. One thing that I noticed was with. Well, Ian McKellen. When he was offered the role of Magneto, he was doing Gandalf for Lord of the Rings. And he was originally going to decline, but when he spoke to Bryan Singer about it, Singer arranged to rearrange the filming schedule so Ian McKellen could still be Magneto. And I thought that was really amazing on Bryan Singer's part. To actually wait and say, I really want you for this role. And he fit it so well.
Yeah, I mean, perfect cast for that role. And to the point where they're still using them in the new movies.
Like, yeah.
On top of the new Professor X Magneto, you're getting, you know, Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen. Like,
yeah.
Just a wonderful role.
And even with Logan that comes out today, we've
Patrick
got
Stewart.
Patrick Stewart. In that film.
Now, yeah, I mean, we'll see when the movie comes out what other Easter eggs they put in it. Obviously, we haven't seen it. But, you know, the makers of Logan, they've come out and said, you know, hey, this is not like a direct sequel. We're not even saying it's in the same universe. Like,
and that's okay.
Yeah, like, we're just going to tell a really good story.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about all the X-Men movies. Like, First Class came out. I was like, great. Like, it's a great X-Men story.
Mm-hmm.
It's like going to the comic store. You pick up a new comic. Just because it has X-Men on the title doesn't mean you're getting continuity X-Men.
Yes.
You know, you're getting a miniseries or an alternate universe, whatever.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Old Man Logan is.
Yeah.
It's an alternate universe. It's mm-hmm. not the same universe as the original X-Men. And
yeah.
I mean, with the whole comic genre right now with Secret Wars, they brought Old Man Logan back.
Yeah, into the main.
Yeah.
I guess I've always liked those alternate universe stories. Some of my favorite comics of all time are alternate stories. And so when the movies came out, not just X-Men, but I mean all superhero movies, all superhero TV shows, I'm just okay with them breaking any rules they want to the comics because it's not the comic.
Yeah.
Like, this is a movie. They're going to tell a good movie. And if you make a good comic book, it would not make a good movie because you wrote it, you drew it, you produced it for the page.
Yep.
And if you make a good movie, the same things don't work. So I'll get off my soapbox about it, but
no, but you're very accurate with that description because this is a very good dynamic to talk about with one of the first superhero movies of the modern age with X-Men. We get a different dynamic from what is in the comics, and maybe it gets a lot of criticism because of that, but the movie universe and the comic universe is totally different. And yeah. I'm okay with that.
I think it's... People are so attached to the characters. And I think when you talk to Joe Patrick about Superman, this, I mean, it'll come out, and I don't want to speak for Joe, but he loves Superman.
Yeah.
He loves Superman the way, like, the way I love my kids. He loves Superman. And so when you make a Superman movie that's not true to the character that Joe loves, I don't know that it offends him, but he's not happy about it. Whereas maybe I don't love the X-Men as strongly or passionately enough, and I'm able to step back, but it's just, you've got to be able to let these guys make good stories, make good movies, and accept it as something different than the comic you love.
Yeah.
And we're getting so many freaking movies. Like, we're getting so many superhero movies that you've got to let... There's got to be a Superman that kills, and there's got to be a dark, gritty DC universe. And in a couple of years, we'll get a nice, bright Superman. It'll just fluctuate, and that's fine.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about X-Men is, with Ryan Singer doing the movie, he had initially turned down the film 3 different times. And then finally he had thought that the comics were unintelligent literature. And yet this caused some really big stirs. I mean, X-Men in general is a big stir because it focuses on prejudice and racism and has you handle these deep-seated issues of comics or of the world in the form of comics. What do you think about that?
And I mean, to be honest, like, a lot of 90s X-Men comics that weren't very good. Like, you can go buy a lot of really just okay comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you find there are some comics that sell because of the character. How the character handles reactions, the humor of the character, whatever the case may be. But the story itself is just a vehicle to deliver that dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Like Deadpool or Harley Quinn. These are characters that people love the character, and they don't really care what the character does.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter who Deadpool is killing. It's the jokes he's making while he finds himself in this situation. So those comics aren't going to be great.
No.
And so X-Men comics, it might be the banter of a team, but the setting for that banter might be really bad.
Yeah.
So I think myself included, comic fans are easily offended when you talk poorly about comics. But, you know, if you're only exposed to really okay comics,
yeah,
pretty easy assessment to say.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah. But you know, when we look at the X-Men movie that we're talking about today, it's really an amazing piece of work. It was really well shot. There was a lot of really good camera angles in it. There was a lot of special effects that were actually practical effects, like most of Hugh Jackman's stunts, he did himself.
Yeah,
he didn't have other people do them. And then even Rebecca Romijn Stamos, she did a lot of her own stunts.
Ray Park as well. Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really good movie, but I think if you look at it in the same vein of the comics I was just talking about, it's an okay story.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a great movie because the plot was so fantastic, or, you know, it was a movie about characters,
mm-hmm.
and the plot just served as the vehicle to get those characters together.
Yeah.
The movie is that okay level story, just like the comics. You know, that's not why you love the movie. That's not why you love the comics. So, but yeah, the cinematography of the movie was good. The practical effects. It was nice to see that reel. And the first time we're going to bring up the music. I was thinking about this as, you know, they have these settings of Canada, you mm-hmm. know, across the country. They're in New York. They're all over the place. And the music has very distinct cues for each location.
Michael Kamen did a really good job with bringing out a lot of those specific, like, almost themes, but it was more like an area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have this totally different environment, and it was more of an organic nature for the scenes in Canada.
I think about when Wolverine is driving with Rogue in the, well, first in the back and then in the passenger seat, the music during that drive. I don't know how it happens, but that music is different than if you were in, say, South Dakota driving.
Yeah.
Like, there's a difference, and I'm not the composer, so I don't know how he does it, but you almost feel the cold in the music.
Yeah, yeah. And the same thing with being in Westchester, New York.
Yeah.
It was fast. When you're at the mutant school, which is in that environment, Michael Kamen brings out that quick cues and those strings, and really brings out like a full flush of new characters mm-hmm. that you're introduced to, but it's through the music.
Yeah.
And you get a highlight of what this school is and what it does. And yeah, I really liked that
scene where all the kids are running around on the X campus or whatever it's called. Like, the sheer complexity of the music during that scene is a mirror of how much is going on in the background and stuff, versus Logan driving through the, you know, Canadian wilderness. Not a lot. I mean, the music is good, but it's not, there aren't as many instruments. There isn't as much overlap and stuff. So
it's more simple, yep. which is nice to see, that someone like Michael Kamen, who has done things like Highlander, and even with that score, you don't hear it a lot with the Highlander score.
Well, because you get the Queen.
have Queen in there. But when you listen to the score, I've had an opportunity to sample that music, and it actually has a very dark feel, and it's a very dark movie.
Yeah.
So I think Michael Kamen did an amazing job with this film, because he brought out the highlights of kind of the brightness of New York, and then you see the darkness of Magneto's lair.
Yes.
And you get that music to help along with the story.
Yeah. So Logan comes out today. Marco Beltrami, composer mm-hmm. that we talked about a couple weeks ago.
He's doing the music.
For us, maybe he did the music for Logan. So it'll be interesting to see how...
Yeah, I imagine that it's going to be kind of a more quiet score.
Yeah.
Mark Beltrami is known for that. He did Hellboy.
Yeah.
He did Hellboy. He did one of the Underworld movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that score is very subdued.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how that score will rate on my level.
Yeah. I mean, he's done, like, we talked about him obviously for Resident Evil. He's done a lot. So it'll be good.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see if he brings, Hellboy type, or if he brings that 310 to Yuma.
Yeah.
And he also replaced somebody, I forget who, but they had a composer for Logan.
Mm-hmm.
And he stepped in.
I'll have to look that up again,
because
I failed to look that up.
Oh, and, no, we're talking X-Men, I'm off topic. But
oh, that's all right.
We'll
because
see how
we're
much.
Also, discussing Logan as a character.
Yeah.
And that comes out today, so that's the importance of looking at that, is to see, okay, how is this composer going to do?
Yeah.
And when we compare it to, say, Michael Kamen's original X-Men score, it's very different. And I thought it was interesting, getting back on topic with the original X-Men movie, when we look at Wolverine, when he's confronting Magneto, that look of shock that was with Hugh Jackman and he's looking at Magneto, there's this look of fear on his face when he first sees him in the train.
Yeah.
And
when he finds out, he's not after Wolverine.
Yeah.
That was a good moment. The comic fan in me, I grew up on that relaunch of the X-Men with Jim Lee and all of that. And so when Magneto pulls Wolverine up on the train and spread eagles him, all I could think, like, I remember sitting in the theater just freaking out, thinking he's about to start ripping out a main team out of him. In hindsight, like, yeah, there's no way that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, the movie didn't have that kind of budget, didn't have that technical skill. If they were making it today, yep, he's going to do it.
Yeah. It was really unique. And then he probably had this thought of shock because he didn't think that maybe he was just coming in to make a hole in the train. He actually ripped the entire top of the train off to get to them. And I thought it was really interesting with this movie that they made Rogue to be kind of the primary focus of the film.
Yeah. I mean, I think as a fan, you wanted it to be Kitty Pryde or Jubilee, you know, as the classic Wolverine buddy. But for a film audience, nobody knows who Jubilee is.
And yeah.
I'm like, okay, what does she do? She shoots fireworks?
Okay.
And Kitty Pryde, it was probably simply budget.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a lot easier to pull off a rogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't touch people. Like, that's a really cheap special effect.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and they have, you know, a few special effects for her.
Yeah, but her powers don't cost any money,
you
know, to show her. And it's also a much more humanizing ability.
Mm-hmm.
It's something people can relate to, whether or not they have, you know, you have that ability or not. There's always, you know, the adolescent fear.
Yeah.
And I think it was the right call. It's, again, one of those things where, as a comic fan, it's not what you wanted.
No.
But it's not in a comic book. Things don't cost money. You just draw them.
You know,
like, so you can have whatever powers you want. So Rogue was definitely a better choice than, like, a Jubilee, which I think early drafts, it was Jubilee.
Yeah, I think that is right.
So, as much as I would want to see Kitty Pryde,
Well, we got her in a later movie.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things I liked about the movie, was that it really showed Rogue as a main character, and it wasn't that she had these different types of abilities, like I mentioned in my notes, Paragon abilities, like flight or super strength, invulnerability, speed, a seventh sense.
Yeah.
These are abilities that she didn't have in this movie. And it was mainly because it's Fox versus another, you know, company that was owning the main part of Marvel.
Yeah. But even if the rights weren't an issue, like, you've got to tell a story.
Yeah.
And if Rogue has flight, super strength, all these other things, well, you got to tell how she got them. There's backstory that.
But it's almost that she would need a separate movie for herself to get those abilities.
Yeah. And like, okay, she can fly. Why does she need Wolverine? So I think going to the core of Rogue's abilities, is the right call for the movie.
Yeah.
So,
yep. That she can't touch people, that, it was more like, it made her feel like a loner, and then she had this connection with Logan because
he was a loner. Yeah.
And he wanted to be alone. He didn't really want to be around people.
Yeah.
And that made a really good effect for the film.
Yeah, I think, you look at, like, Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man, there was almost no, Green Goblin, another cheap character. Spider-Man, you put him in a suit. You know, like, you spend your money on the really important stuff. But you look at Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield, and how much more went into that, how much more they spent on that.
Like,
that's what happens when you get 15 years of successful superhero movies, your budget goes up. This movie cost, what, 70
million? It was not very much. Yeah. And they didn't make as much as they thought they would.
Even. 250, I think, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
But at the time, that was a healthy movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, especially for a genre movie like this.
And I thought it was really interesting, you know, getting back to the music. Bryan Singer had originally wanted John Williams.
Yeah.
And I mean...
Doesn't everybody want John
Williams? Yeah, because like, John Williams is... I mean, he can do no wrong. He really can't.
Well, I mean, I think it's...
He does so many different movies that are entire, like, elements of the film that each movie is different.
Yeah.
And he was doing other movies. He was doing Saving Private Ryan at the time. So, of course, he was unavailable.
Yeah. But, I mean, it goes to, like, Bryan Singer being a real fan. Like, Bryan Singer wanted to make franchise.
Yeah.
Like Star Wars, like Star Trek, like Superman. He was thinking five movies.
Yeah.
In a time where the studios were thinking, get this done cheap.
Yeah.
Make us a little money. Like, let's keep the characters. Let's not lose our rights. And Bryan Singer was thinking Star Wars. So it makes sense he would go after John Williams.
Yeah.
But can you imagine if John Williams had scored this movie?
It would have been a really different movie in a way.
I don't think it would have been very good. Like,
you never know.
He would have had to cut the movie around John Williams' score. And I'm like, the movie wasn't filmed for a John Williams. Like, where are those character moments with, you know, Darth Vader coming out of the...
It's possible.
The movie just doesn't... But I mean, the movie didn't have those sequences.
That's true.
To give John... Like, John Williams needs 45 seconds to introduce a character.
At least.
He needs 45 seconds of film time for a guy to walk down the ramp. And the X-Men movie, it wasn't filmed that way.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Bryan Singer would have changed it, but I mean, the movie was made before he went after the composer.
Yeah, and so Michael Kamen was a better choice because he could do it faster.
Well,
and he had the time to be able to view the film footage. And as we've had, the interview from Craig Safin, I mean, that really proved, too, how certain composers get approached for a film score. And
you got to be free.
Yeah. And John Williams wasn't free. Yeah. So I really thought it was good, too, when we look at another character of the X-Men, Patrick Stewart. I mean, he had never heard of X-Men.
Yeah.
But he thought it was the X-Files.
Yeah.
And that was really unique, too. But then he even finally, when he was doing research for the movie, he went ahead and looked up the comics. And he said it was the most fun research he had ever done.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
So he really enjoyed...
He's no stranger to the nerd world, obviously.
Because of doing Star Trek.
Yeah. I always find it funny to hear the stories about the actors doing research like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like going to the there was a the guy who played the Punisher on the new Daredevil season two. There was the comic store that he went to. The guy who sold him the comics like tweeted out their interaction as soon as he left the like. So, blanking on the guy's name, he comes into the store and he's kind of looking around, and the comic shop guy is like starting to recognize who he is, and the news had just broke. And he walks up and he's like, starts putting books in his hands, like, you need to read this, you need to read this, you need to, and pushes him out the door and is like, don't screw this up. And of course, the guy playing Punisher is like, man, what did I get into? So. Yeah, it's always funny to hear that research story.
Yeah, and I mean, it really brings out an element of difference that these actors, some of them like Patrick Stewart, who doesn't really have much familiarity with like the comic book world.
Oh, no. Yeah.
He actually enjoyed doing it. And then what I found really unique, as we've talked about before with some Star Trek connections, that Patrick Stewart and Famke Janssen were both on an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation together. And it was called, it was called The Perfect Mate. And it was about a possible relationship developing between a character that she had been reserved for this prince.
I was having trouble remembering who Famke Jensen, and I just looked at it. I was Jean like, Grey. Oh, yeah. And so, yeah, I remember from, I've been watching Next Generation for about a year, like, going, I've seen it, obviously, but going through, like, all the episodes.
Yeah, I just watched The High Ground not too long ago. So, yeah. I'm such a big Star Trek fan that I was looking at, you know, these different characters that may have been in, you know, X-Men.
Yeah.
And looking, okay, what episodes of Star Trek have they been in? And Famke Janssen, she is the first one that I thought of that stood out in my mind because it made it very similar to her character because she was like an empath.
Yeah.
And she was kind of telekinetic in X-Men. Yep. And she could be able to read people's minds or move things with her mind. And it was just really unique that both of them had that good chemistry on Star Trek.
Yeah.
And then they brought that chemistry back to where they could interact really well together on X-Men.
Are you an X-Men comic fan?
I have been in the past. I haven't read an X-Men book in probably 6-7 months.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on... So Jean Grey, she's obviously older. Like, they're all older versus, like, the X-Men comics where they're teenagers or, like, 20, 21. Mm-hmm. How do you think it changed the dynamic making all those characters older? Jean Grey is the one that stands out for me specifically.
Yeah, well... I have to say that the dynamic for her character in particular, actually, it matured her very well because she was already developing her powers early on. Like, she developed her powers because even in the movie in X-Men, Professor X talks about Jean Grey was one of the first that he found. And that really sparked something in my mind saying... Yeah, she has had these powers for a long time, and she's matured really well in developing them because she's had that time. And she's not a real social person, but she's more shy and trying to hold back things. And there were certain elements of the X-Men movie that brought out details that you could see her character developing to where the Phoenix could be brought out.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see, like, sometimes with her anger or with how she would develop, like, with a certain focus or, like, how she looked at things.
Yeah.
And she was a perfect actress for that character.
Okay. I just rewatched it before we did this, and you know, the first time you see her on screen, she's giving a speech to the Senate. You know, they don't really, I think a Senate.
Yeah, it would have to be the Senate or the body of Congress. Or
I think it was
House of Congress.
Yeah, whoever it was. They leave some of those details vague. You know, she's obviously older and experienced and. But what I didn't get was the impression, this is a criticism of the movie, is the characters are experienced and established, but you didn't get a feel that the campus was aged.
Yeah.
Like, the campus, and I'm not talking like the, you know, building needs to be run down, but the whole campus felt like a new thing, like they had just opened. And maybe they do, but they kind of leave that timeline vague.
Kind of open. And that was a good thing.
Yeah, but it just felt like it was a contrast between how established these X-Men are, but they've never done anything. They've never gone out in public, but they've got these suits and they've got a jet and they all know how to fly. I mean, like, there was just this missing element that, like, have they been doing stuff, but covertly? And if so, how? Like, how did they pull that off? How does the world not know who they are?
But maybe that was Bryan Singer's point, is to be able to say, all right, later, I want to revisit these characters.
Yeah, but they don't, in this movie, like I said, it's like they've been doing this X-Men thing for 10 years, but this is their first mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was just this disconnect between
They should have been younger.
They should have been a whole lot younger, but obviously they couldn't be younger and do the roles they were for this movie. So
yeah.
I think it's, like I said, they needed to be older. I'm glad they were older for this movie. I just think they missed a few cues in, like, hey, why are we so experienced if we've never done this?
Yeah, so exactly. And, you know, there's so many things that we could be talking about in regard to different elements of the movie, like some of the set pieces, the replica of Lady Liberty.
Yeah.
Her head was 1.5 times the size of the real thing. That's pretty large for a set.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been on the Statue of Liberty. Like, I don't know how big it is. But
it's pretty large.
I mean, how many...
From a distance, you can't see it too well, but I've been to New York City and seen the Statue of Liberty, and the size is really big. And when you think about that, the size of the head is even larger, it's pretty impressive so that, like, they built the set that big.
Yeah, so you can go up in the Statue of Liberty?
Mm-hmm.
But which part can you go up
to? You can go up to the head.
The head?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because there's a ladder inside, and then you can even go up to the lamp.
Okay.
Because so you can go that far up.
Okay.
So it's just really impressive that they built a set that was that large. I thought it was interesting that the executive producer, Tom DeSanto, compared Wolverine to Steve McQueen and Clint Eastwood.
Oh, yeah.
So, definitely. You know, you get that he just has the presence on scene. And I thought that was really unique.
What do you think of the claw cling on the Statue of Liberty? How he, like, flips around?
It actually made me dizzy.
The camera move?
Because the camera move, fortunately, I was sitting down when I was watching it. So it just had an element of, whoa, I didn't realize that was going to happen there.
I think it took me out of the film for a minute because all I could think about was how. Like, how do you do that if your claws can cut through it? But anyways.
Well, it fell off.
Yeah, but how was he able to swing around it before it's... why didn't he just slice right through?
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, anyway, that's a small matter.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've got a few cues I'd like for us to consider today. The first is Death Camp.
Oh, yeah.
That's a major scene that develops Magneto's character and really brings out his powers, and you realize that he has the power to move metal. And with that very scene, how do you think that the music adds drama to the film?
I mean, that's a scene that they've used in probably all 10 X-Men movies. Like, they spent a lot of money on that scene, and they give it a lot of airtime. The music, I mean, it's perfectly cued, you know, to give the sound effects room to grow into it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You get the fence bending, or, you know, whatever... bending and breaking, and you get that metal screeching.
Yeah.
And it blends right into the music.
Yeah.
I liked that even after the fence is bent, that it's almost like the echo of that fence carrying through
the music
to the puddle. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think that's a good example of why the score is done after the movie.
Yeah.
Is finished.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good way of doing it. I find that as I've looked at different movies and as I've looked at how they've done scoring through some of these films, some of the directors want the scoring to be done as they're filming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's really hard to do because I don't know what's coming after.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it takes longer, costs more money.
Exactly.
But I think it's like you can be a really good director. You know, you could be to use a student grade analogy, you could be an A director with a C level grasp on music.
Yeah.
You know, like your director's strengths can be cinematography, special effects, and music could just be kind of like, well, I guess we need it. Or you could be an A in music. Mm-hmm. And so.
And Michael Kamen does an amazing job. So now let's hear Death Camp. All right, so the next cue I'd like to play is called The Mutant School. There's actually a very difference in the expanded edition compared to the regular soundtrack that's come out. But I'll be playing the one that's the expanded edition because it actually adds another 30 to 40 seconds worth of music to the cue. And it really brings out this glorious, like, full scene of seeing all these kids that are having these different abilities and how Logan perceives this whole...
Coming out of the tunnels.
Yeah.
And, you know, he thinks he's in the camp or in the, like, place where he's, you know, performed on. Mm-hmm. And then he emerges and he's in paradise.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, big contrast in the music there. So.
Yeah. So now let's go ahead and play Logan in the Mutant School.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the next cue I'd like to play is a combination of three from the album. The first is called Train, then Magneto Standoff, and the X-Jet. Now, with these cues, what really stands out in your mind for these elements of music that add to the film?
I think I'm gonna pick on the X-Jet. You know, okay. Like this is the Blackbird is part of X-Men lore, you know, mm-hmm. like it is a character. And there's so many stories that take place in and around it. So to see it, that was kind of the sleeper for this movie. Like everyone knew who the characters were when they walked into the theater. You knew which characters were going to be on screen, you know, which villains you're going to get. You know, this is, to put a modern spin on it, like this is Giant Man in Civil War. You're like the X-Jet, you know? So the music just like hits that. Like right when you see the Blackbird, it just jumps up.
Yeah.
And then when they're flying over, coming in on the Statue of Liberty and they, you know, they cloak and they go down and Storm calls up the Mist. There's that one scene where the Blackbird comes down low. Probably one of my favorite musical moments in the whole movie mm-hmm. is just when it comes down low and she calls up the cloud or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever she calls
and
up.
I like that cue also for the specific reason that it brings that main X-Men movie theme
yeah.
into the film. Now, with this first movie, they didn't really establish a full theme for X-Men until the second movie, X-Men United.
Yeah.
And Michael Kamen, with doing the first score, he brought in this minor little cue that was perfect for the X-Men theme. John Ottman built on that, and it developed into the full X-Men movie theme of what we know now.
Yeah. That's where knowing John Williams would have been it. Like,
yeah,
you almost want there to be a Superman level theme or a Star Wars theme. Mm-hmm. You know? So,
yeah. And so that's how it built. So now let's go ahead and play these three cues.
We'll be right back.
lastly, we've got two cues to play. And one is called Logan and Rogue. And then we have Checkmate and the End Title. And the point about these, when looking back on the movie, how do you think the newer movies have changed over the original story that was procured for this film?
So new movies compared to the old?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, special effects budget. I mean, there's just no way you can avoid that conversation. You know, First Class, you get twice the number of characters in it. Every single one of them has a special effects budget.
Mm-hmm.
This movie, you chose characters because of how cheap you could pull off their effects. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't have Angel because it's expensive to have people fly. You know, when Storm flies, it's very like obvious that you're not seeing her whole body. So I think the special effects are the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 10 years, you look at X-Men 2000 versus First Class, and you're going to kind of look at them the same way. I mean, you have fantastic casting for both Professor X and Magneto
mm-hmm.
In both trilogies.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the cast is just bonus.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. I mean, they'll both play out the same in 20 years. But I think the budget is the main difference.
Yeah. And then when you look at the music, you see a development of the music that it actually has expanded and become its own animal in a way, because John Ottman has become the pro facto X-Men composer.
Yeah.
Bryan Singer hasn't gotten any other composer except John Ottman. And the reason is, well, Michael Kamen died, for one, and for another, John Ottman has been developed as a X-Men composer.
Well, yeah. I mean,
and he's done other films as well, but he's known for that.
We've talked about that, how a director will latch onto one composer.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes them a couple movies to get to know each other. So it's great when you can keep one team. You know, it's like in sports, you know, you have the coach and a star. You know, the longer you can keep the two of them together, the more likely you're going to win. You know, so.
Yeah. So now let's go ahead. I mean, what we're going to do is listen to this final cue. In fact, it's very exciting because next week we're going to be talking about Skull Island and also going into the music of Max Steiner from the original 1933 release of King Kong.
And all its black and white glory.
Yeah. But it's going to be really exciting. We're going to really enjoy that. So I urge you all to enjoy next week as well. And so I hope you enjoy this last cue with Logan and Rogue, and then Checkmate and End Title. Happy listening.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley Spotlight. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Also, if you want to leave a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com and enjoy looking at my blog at soundtrackalley.com.